The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter and also from the Harvard Health Letter. I'm going to start with an article entitled Elder Abuse and Neglect, Know the Warning Signs. This is from the March Health Letter of the Mayo Clinic. You've noticed that your friend has seemed down lately and maybe even a little jumpy. You ask if he's feeling okay, but he brushes off your questions. One day, you arrive at his house early and overhear his son screaming at him and berating him. Now you're sure something is very wrong. What do you do? Unfortunately, this situation is common. Elder mistreatment, including abuse and neglect, happens to older adults living in the community and in residential facilities, and can be perpetrated by caregivers, friends, and family. It's important to know the warning signs and what actions to take if you know or suspect that you, a loved one, or even an acquaintance is being mistreated. Elder abuse can be physical, emotional, or sexual. Older adults can also be mistreated by caregivers who neglect them, depriving them of basic needs such as adequate food, medication, cleanliness, or attention. Older adults are also sometimes exploited, swindled, or coerced out of their money and property, a phenomenon known as financial abuse. Sometimes older adults are unable to take care of themselves, and this is known as self-neglect. It's very difficult to estimate how commonly older adults are mistreated. Many cases are not reported, as victims may feel ashamed or fear retaliation. One research review found that over the span of a year, an estimated 16% of older adults living in communities, rather than institutional facilities such as nursing homes, throughout the world experienced mistreatment. However, due to underreporting, the real rate of mistreatment is thought to be higher. Sadly, adult children and spouses are commonly the perpetrators. There are many possible health consequences of mistreatment. They're often related to neglect, such as falls, not taking medication, or taking too much medication. They may include serious physical injuries, sexually transmitted infections, and emotional distress. Most seriously, mistreatment is associated with an increased risk of death. Certain adults are at a higher risk of being mistreated, including those who are socially isolated and people with cognitive impairment. Keep these three actions in mind when keeping an eye out for warning signs. First of all, you need to look. Watch for injuries such as bed sores or suspicious scars, cuts, burns, or bruises, shaped like fingers or hands, especially if they're repeated. Accidental, non-abusive bruises in older adults are often on their arms or legs. Be wary of larger bruises and those on areas such as the head, the back of the trunk, or the neck. Check to see if clothes look like they haven't been cleaned or aren't weather appropriate, or if it looks like the person hasn't been bathed. Look for unexplained weight loss, which could signal neglect or self-neglect. Examine your surroundings. If utilities are turned off or the home is dirty or unsafe, this could be a sign of neglect or financial abuse. Listen. Pay attention if a loved one doesn't satisfactorily account for injuries. Be suspicious if you hear someone yelling at, threatening, or humiliating an older adult. Note, inquire further if an older adult is suddenly unable to pay bills or purchase items such as medication or food, as it could signal financial abuse. Other signs include questionable charges in a bank account or an important document such as a will or a power of attorney. Pay attention if an older adult seems withdrawn or isolated, as this may be a red flag. Emotions such as agitation, fear, depression, and confusion also can indicate that something is wrong. Ask if he or she is going without medications, glasses, or hearing aids. If you suspect abuse, If you think an older adult is a victim of abuse or neglect, voice your concerns in a private conversation. If the person is in immediate danger, call the police. If the person is not in immediate danger, then contact the Elder Care Locator at 800-677-1116 or visit https://eldercare.acl.gov. This will direct you to local organizations to report the suspected abuse. If you are a victim or are experiencing self-neglect, reach out to someone you trust, like a faith leader, a doctor, or a family member. It's crucial that you report abuse or mistreatment, even if you're not completely certain. Abuse and neglect can be a matter of life and death. If you have suspicions of abuse and are making a report in good faith, that's enough. Now I'm going to turn to a couple of second opinions from the health letter of the Mayo Clinic. The first is a question. I recently had a very painful diverticulitis attack. Are there foods I shouldn't eat to help avoid an attack in the future? Actually, current recommendations for those with diverticulitis are more about trying to incorporate high-fiber foods than eliminating specific foods from your diet. Diverticula are small, bulging pouches that can form in the lining of your digestive system and most commonly occur in the last portion of the colon. Diverticula are common, especially as you age, and seldom cause problems. Sometimes, though, one or more of the pouches become inflamed or infected, a condition called diverticulitis. Diverticulitis can cause severe abdominal pain, typically around the lower left side of your abdomen, fever, nausea, and a marked change in your bowel habits. It can even necessitate hospitalization. After you've recovered from a diverticulitis attack, try eating a high-fiber diet including fresh fruits, vegetables, beans, and whole grains. Women over the age of 50 should aim for 21 grams of fiber a day, and men over 50 should aim for 30 grams. You may want to cut down on red meat, as it's been associated with a higher risk of diverticulitis. Exercising vigorously and maintaining a healthy weight may also help reduce diverticulitis risk. You may have heard it's best to avoid nuts, seeds, and popcorn, but there's really no evidence that these foods cause diverticulitis. One study even found that nuts and popcorn reduce diverticulitis risk. Now I'm going to turn to the Mayo Clinic issue of August 2020, the health letter. It's subtitled Reliable Information for a Healthier Life. The first article is about back surgery. It says that back surgery is often the best last resort. Back pain comes in a variety of forms. For most people, the aches and pains go away with time and can be managed with targeted physical therapy, medications, and other non-surgical approaches. But what do you do when you've tried the non-surgical approaches without much success? Surgery may be an option. It's not a cure-all for any type of back pain, but it can be very effective in some situations. Surgery for back pain, or sciatica, is usually reserved for problems in which a nerve near the spinal cord is severely irritated or pinched. It may also be considered in cases of impaired function, when the spinal cord is compressed, or if the spine becomes unstable. There are some situations in which the immediate surgery may be indicated. Fortunately for most people, surgery becomes an appropriate option only after the body has had ample time to heal from an injury, and when more conservative measures have failed. Surgery may also be warranted if there is a severe unremitting pain, or if you develop arm or leg weakness, loss of bowel or bladder control, and other complications. But surgery isn't without potential complications. Recovery may take weeks or months depending on the severity of the condition and your overall health. A successful recovery, usually involving physical therapy, may require significant rehabilitation effort and time away from work or hobbies. For these reasons, consider getting a second opinion from a qualified spine surgeon before you agree to back surgery. What are the steps short of surgery? When back pain lasts longer than 3 months, it's considered chronic. For some people, chronic back pain has an identifiable cause that can be managed or treated surgically at the appropriate time. In other cases, there may be a cause like obesity, deconditioning, or widespread arthritis, for which surgery won't help, but neither can you expect the problem to resolve and the pain to completely go away. At other times, chronic back pain may result when nerves transmitting back pain signals to the pain centers of the brain become persistently activated or sensitized. When this occurs, the pain message is amplified and is out of proportion to the original disease or injury, or even continues when the original problem is healed or improved. This is called chronic pain syndrome or central sensitization. This diagnosis is often reached after an in-depth evaluation effort with many trials of therapy. Common self-care steps and certain doctor or therapist-assisted steps, such as staying as active as you're able, developing an exercise routine, using heat or ice as needed, and taking pain medications, are still an important part of reducing chronic pain and regaining function. But there are additional steps that may be recommended for chronic pain. These include acceptance of the condition. You may need to shift your thinking from an expected cure for shorter-term pain and physical limitation to acceptance that back discomfort and restriction of activity may be long-term. Psychological or mind-body therapy. Living with chronic pain can have serious effects on your emotions and sense of well-being. Cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, is a widely used method to help you change the thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that contribute to the pain and to cope with the frustrations, worry, and sadness that are often associated with persistent pain. Drug options beyond pain relievers. Antidepressant drugs are often used to help diminish pain and help you to get a good night's sleep. These drugs can be used even if you don't have depression. But if you do, they also help treat the depression and insomnia that can accompany chronic pain. Pain rehabilitation. A pain rehabilitation program combines therapeutic approaches that may include medications, improving health and fitness, managing stress, psychological care, group therapy, and family counseling. This is a reasonable option to consider when there's no surgical treatment for your diagnosis. Surgical options. Spinal surgery can play a critical role in providing pain relief when it's indicated. Depending on the issues you have, your doctor may recommend a discectomy. This involves removal of the herniated portion of the disc to relieve pressure on a nerve. When done as an open surgery, it typically involves full or partial removal of the top portion of a vertebrae, which is called the lamina, to access the worn or injured disc. In many cases, disc material can be removed through a small incision with the aid of an optical device to magnify the area of operation. This procedure, called a microdiscectomy, may reduce the amount of pain after surgery and result in a shorter recovery period. In recent years, additional advances in minimally invasive techniques have been embraced. Rather than gaining access to the disc by cutting muscle and supporting tissues, surgeons insert a small tube called a tubal retractor through the skin, soft tissue, and muscle, then expand it to allow visualization of the area and disc removal. Another option involves the use of a laser to remove part of the disc. These surgical techniques can provide short-term benefits like reduced after-surgery pain and quicker recovery. The long-term outcomes for people having the minimally invasive procedure have proved similar to those who have traditional approaches. Another type of surgery is a laminectomy. This procedure involves the removal of the bone over the top of the vertebrae that overlays the spinal cord. It enlarges the spinal canal, creating more space that relieves nerve pressure caused by narrowing of the spine or spinal stenosis. Also, the doctor may do a spinal fusion. A spinal fusion permanently connects two or more bones in your spine. It can relieve pain by adding stability to a spinal fracture or areas of severe arthritis, or by stopping excessive movement between vertebrae. It also may be used to eliminate painful motion between vertebrae that can result from a worn or injured disc. Spinal fusion involves placing small pieces of bone, either from your own body or from a bone bank, in the spaces between vertebrae. Over time, this usually stimulates your body to grow enough new bone in that area to fuse the vertebrae together. The process is similar to the way a bone heals after a fracture. In select cases, some surgeons use a synthetic substance instead of bone grafts, which helps promote bone growth and speed the fusion of the vertebrae. Sometimes wires, rods, screws, metal cages, or plates are used to facilitate the fusion process. Because success depends on your ability to grow bone to fuse together, recovery may take several months and is often influenced by your general health and your ability to complete rehabilitation. You may have to restrict your activity for 3 to 6 months. A traditional approach to fusion surgery involves accessing the spine with incisions in either the lower back or the front of the body. A newer approach, known as lateral interbody fusion, allows a surgeon to access your spine with an incision through your side to avoid the pain and weakness that comes from cutting back muscles or moving nerves. As with minimally invasive discectomy, a tubal retractor may be used to hold muscles open and give a clear view of the spine. These less invasive techniques often result in less pain and a speedier recovery and may reduce hospital stays by several days. Another procedure is a vertebroplasty or kyphoplasty, and this is an outpatient procedure used to stabilize compression fractures in the spine. Compression fractures occur when one or more spine bones weaken to the point that they crumple. Bone cement is injected into cracked or broken vertebrae to support the spine. With kyphoplasty, a balloon-like device is inserted to expand compressed vertebrae before bone cement is injected. These procedures are intended to relieve pain and increase mobility, but there is a debate about how effective they are. Spinal stimulation. With this technology, a device known as a spinal cord stimulator is implanted in the back. Similar to how a pacemaker sends signals to regulate the heart rhythm, it delivers electrical pulses to nerves in the spinal cord to override pain signals. The device has been shown to help when other measures or surgeries fail to provide pain relief, or if you're unable to tolerate or unlikely to be helped by a traditional spine operation. The next article in the health letter of the Mayo Clinic from August of 2020 is about diabetes medications. Weigh the options. You were already overwhelmed when your doctor first diagnosed you with type 2 diabetes. You did all you could, improved your diet, cut out sugary sodas and juices, used your gym membership, and even shed a few pounds. But now your doctor has said that in addition to all that, you need medication to manage your diabetes. And you're utterly confused by the long list of drug options. The good news is that the many available options make it more likely that you and your healthcare provider will find treatment options that work best for you, and a close look at the pros and cons of each choice can help. Type 2. Type 2 diabetes is a chronic condition that affects how your body uses the sugar in your blood, or glucose, an important source of fuel for your body. With type 2 diabetes, your body either resists the effects of insulin, a hormone that enables sugar to enter your cells, or doesn't produce enough insulin. Instead of moving into your body's cells where it's needed, sugar builds up in your bloodstream. This means your blood sugar levels are too high, and this is called hyperglycemia. Poor long-term management of these blood sugar levels can lead to complications such as kidney damage, heart disease, stroke, nerve damage, vision loss, and foot problems. A healthy diet, weight control, and physical activity provide the foundation for managing type 2 diabetes. However, diabetes drugs or insulin therapy also may be necessary. The decision about which medications are best depends on many factors, like health problems, possible side effects, and cost. Sometimes a single drug is effective, but often a combination of medications is necessary. The immediate goal of diabetes medication is to lower your blood sugar. One way to measure your blood sugar is a common blood test called the A1C. The A1C test result reflects your average blood sugar level for the past 2 to 3 months. Specifically, the A1C test measures what percentage of your hemoglobin, a protein in red blood cells that carries oxygen, is coated with sugar. The higher your A1C level, the poorer your blood sugar control. Normal A1C in people who don't have diabetes or prediabetes is less than 5.7. For many adults who have diabetes, an A1C of 7 or lower is the treatment target, if it can be achieved safely. This is sometimes known as intensive glycemic control, and it can reduce the risk of developing diabetes complications. More moderate glycemic control of around 7 to 8.5 is sometimes recommended for older adults, or those with chronic or severe diseases, or those who experience severe low blood sugar side effects. In fact, a recent Mayo Clinic research review suggests that moderate glycemic control, in other words, keeping the A1C between 7 and 8.5, may be more generally acceptable as an option for many patients with type 2 diabetes. The review found that intensive glycemic control did not lead to lower rates of health problems like end-stage kidney disease, blindness, nerve pain, stroke, lower extremity amputations, or death. But intensive glycemic control did lower the risk of non-fatal heart attacks. Additionally, pursuing intensive glycemic control, in other words, keeping the A1C level 7 or lower, brings a higher risk of severe hypoglycemia, which can be very serious. It can even be deadly. Intensive glycemic control may also result in a greater burden on those with diabetes, like the need to take more medications and experience more side effects and pay more money for medication. Part of your discussions with your healthcare provider should center on the fine line between enough treatment to prevent complications and too much treatment that could cause blood sugar levels to fall too low. A healthcare professional may recommend that you regularly self-test your blood sugar between A1C tests and tell you how often to do so. Testing can be done with a portable device called a glucometer using a small drop of your blood, but there are also newer devices called continuous glucose monitors. Continuous glucose monitors measure your blood sugar every few minutes using a tiny sensor inserted under the skin. Mayo Clinic experts advise checking your blood sugar no matter what drug you take, though frequency varies by drug. Blood sugar checks are needed if you are at risk or feel symptoms of hyperglycemia, which is possible no matter what drug you're taking, or hypoglycemia, which can be caused by certain drugs. Hyperglycemia may start with frequent urination, blurred vision, and fatigue, and then progress to nausea, vomiting, and shortness of breath. Hypoglycemia can cause shakiness, sweating, a racing heart rate, irritability, and progress to slurred speech, confusion, and seizures. The article shows a very handy list of commonly prescribed medications, including metformin, GLP-1 receptor agonists. These have names like Victoza and Trulicity, SGLT2 inhibitors, which have names like Jardiance and Invokana, DPP-4 inhibitors, which have names like Tradjenta and Januvia, thiazolidinediones, which have names like Actos and Avandia, and the somewhat old-fashioned sulfonylureas, which have names like Amaryl, Leukotrol, and Diabeta. The article explains how often these drugs are typically prescribed and how much blood sugar reduction you can get. It also goes over the significant risk of low blood sugar. And this is especially a risk with the sulfonylureas like Amaryl and Leukotrol. It also points out that weight change can be seen with these drugs. For example, a significant weight loss can be seen with the GLP-1 receptor agonists, where 2 to 3 pound weight gain is sometimes seen with the sulfonylureas and thiazolidinediones. It also goes over the advantages and disadvantages. For example, the advantage of metformin is its low cost, and metformin is usually the first drug prescribed for type 2 diabetes. The advantages of GLP-1 receptor agonists are that they promote weight loss, and they may improve kidney and cardiovascular health. The SGLT2 inhibitors lower blood pressure and promote weight loss. The DPP-4 inhibitors like Tradjenta and Januvia don't affect weight. The advantages of the sulfonylureas are that they are quite inexpensive drugs and often work well with other oral diabetes drugs. It goes over the side effects as well. The common side effects of metformin are nausea and diarrhea. The common side effects of GLP-1 inhibitors are nausea and vomiting. The SGLT2 inhibitors can cause urinary tract infections and can sometimes cause diabetic ketoacidosis. The thiazolidinediones like Actos and Avandia have been associated with fluid retention and heart failure, as well as an increased risk of bone fractures, and they are generally not a first-choice treatment because of their associated risks. Well, it looks like we run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Yunkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.